good morning, or good evening, or good afternoon, or good middle of the night, wherever you happen to be on this rotating globe that we all share, all 7+ billion of us. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and for the next 2 hours, I'm your host on the other side of midnight, that time between dusk and dawn where things that don't quite fit in the light of day, when the sun goes down and this time rolls around, look actually pretty interesting. Now, we're going to have an extraordinary morning. I have someone on that I've wanted to have on for some time, and we're going to chat about all kinds of things ancient and modern. If that's not a paradox, we'll resolve in the next 2 hours. You have to stay with us to find out. But before we get to that, I want to take a couple of minutes here to make some comments about the current political campaign. Now, I know an awful lot of you out there, when I say the word politics or political, you cringe. You look at turning off your device or throwing it into the nearest lake or whatever. Look, if we're going to continue to live in a republic, we got to kind of pay attention. There's an awful lot of interesting stuff going on both sides, and even that is a kind of an interesting statement, because when was life reduced to just two sides? One of the confounding elements of Donald Trump's run for the presidency is that he appears to combine both sides. Some of his positions are very, conservative. Others are, frankly, quite liberal. And it's going to be intriguing as heck, to see how the electorate, particularly the Republican electorate, on that side of the aisle, responds as we get closer and closer to some of these determinative races like Iowa and New Hampshire. Now, over the weekend, new polls came out, and the polls are as extraordinarily fulfilling of some predictions we've made here as anything I can imagine. Trump is leading everywhere. Bernie Sanders is within 7 points of Hillary in Iowa. She has fallen 20 points since May, and the electorate appears to be on both sides of this polarization, this spectrum. They appear to be, shall we say, restless. At the very least, they're restless. And they're asking questions, and they're following people who are not towing the party line. One of the things that I find a little disturbing, and apparently it was echoed tonight, a friend of mine sent me an email. I didn't have time to listen to Art tonight, but apparently he had David Darling on as a guest. And Darling's position was that we should never try to colonize Mars or send an expedition or live there or transplant human beings, etc. And by, of course, metonymy, that means the rest of the solar system. And to me, that kind of thinking, that we're not up to the job, is very similar to the kind of thinking that's behind Trump's, super great wall sealing us off from the South. And now, Governor Walker's super great wall that he's proposing to seal us off from the North. What kind of Americans do these people think we are? Are we timid? Are we fearful? Are we going to huddle behind our walls as the rest of the world evolves and changes and metamorphizes into the 22nd century? I don't think I don't think it's very American. I think we're bigger and better and made of sterner stuff. And the fact that we're all afraid, apparently, at least from that perspective, of people who come here, even if people come here illegally. I mean, frankly, for most of time, most people came here illegally. It was the big unknown continent. It was where the future could be born. It was where you could be anything you wanted to be and more. If we hold out that light beside the golden door, paraphrasing a certain poem, that's who we are. That's who Americans are. We assimilate, we translate, we integrate, and then we move on and we do extraordinary things. Of all the cultures on this planet, we do the most extraordinary things, not, as Kennedy said, because we are fearful, but because we are looking to the far horizon, to the far frontier. And if we lose that, and some of the candidates this year are making weird noises, that we have in fact lost that, and we should be huddled behind our walls, clutching our guns and staring into the darkness as if something is out there that's going to come and get us, we will no longer in my opinion, be Americans. Anyway, maybe I should start something new at the top of the show, kind of like, you know, O'Reilly's memos. Maybe I can get some things off my chest if I put it in the context of a memo. Anyway, my guest this morning is Dr. Mike Evidence. He is the Emeritus Professor of Astrophysics at Cardiff University and former head of the School of Physics and Astronomy. He was educated at Cambridge, but has lived and worked in Wales for over 35 years. His main research career involved the determination and interpretation of the abundances of chemical elements in the universe and an investigation of the origins of interstellar dust. Later work focused on the history of astronomy, on science and society, and Mike is currently chair of the Antikythera Mechanism Research Project, which, of course, is one of the main topics of our conversation this morning, chair of the Astronomical Heritage Committee of the Royal Astronomical Society, a former member of two UK research councils, the Particle Physics and Astronomy Research Council and the Science and Technology Facilities Council, and can occasionally be seen in his one-man play about Newton, Sir Isaac Remembers. And we're going to start with that first. Mike, and I'm going to call you Mike because you can call me Richard, and that way we get past all the other stuff. Mike, are you doing in this one-man play what Hal Holbrook did with Mark Twain?
Well, I'm afraid I've never seen...
Oh, my gosh. He does in one on stage on a stool just basically being Mark Twain for an hour or 2 hours. Is that what you do?
It's a sort of similar thing. Basically, there's a table, and on the table is a box. And in the box are a lot of Isaac Newton's old letters that he's written over the years and letters that have been written to him. And he's in the last year of his life, and he's sorting them out. And he just talks to the audience about his life and his researches and reads the letters and gives the audience advice and what he thinks of the world and so on. It lasts about an hour. And it sort of gives a picture of that extraordinary man that he was.
That sounds fascinating. Where have you performed this?
Oh, all over the place, all around the UK. In fact, I have performed it in America a couple of times. I was in Oklahoma some years ago and did it there. But it's really for scientific societies. It started off with a student society, really, who asked me to give a talk. And I thought, well, I was going to talk about Newton because I was interested in it. And I thought, well, they might like something a bit different than a straight talk. So it ended up being a play.
So you sit there in costume with the wig and everything, and you read from your letters to...
Well, I have the costume, but I don't need the wig. My hair looks like that anyway.
Well, that's true. I'm looking at your picture right now. How has it been received?
Very. I only do it about three times a year or so, but it's normally pretty well received. And I think it's quite good in sort of opening people's eyes to scientists of people. Newton was a very interesting person. One of the most fascinating things about him, he had a great biographer, Richard Westphal, who wrote a very, very fine biography of him called Never at Rest, because he was a very restless person, Newton. And I love the remark in this biography that he says that he'd spent something like 20 years writing this biography because he wanted to know Newton better. And he says, all I can say is that after that 20 years of writing, he seems to have receded from me. Extraordinary thing for a biographer to say. He was such a complex, unusual, very difficult person that he's a great subject because he's just so there's so much about him that's unknown, so much that's strange about him, and so on.
Now, it's unknown because we don't have the records, or because there's been a political effort to kind of downplay aspects of his career. For instance, he was really interested, if I remember, in religion, but not in conventional religion.
Indeed. It's not that anything's been suppressed, or there is, in fact, a great deal of material. One thing that is extraordinary about just how many of his letters and writings do survive. I mean, millions of words, and a lot of it's now freely available on the internet, so if anybody wants to have a look at it, they can start doing so. It's taken a long time, mind you. The thing is that he is such an unusual mind that it does, it really does take quite a lot of digging into. And, you know, as Westphal said, the more you dig, the more strange you find the guy.
Now, that's curious. What would you say was the most unusual aspect, you know, besides being the giant of giants that he was, what was the thing that kind of struck your imagination?
just how active he was in a way. I mean, his work in mathematics and his work in the physical sciences was only a tiny part of what he did. He was interested in alchemy, as you've mentioned, religious studies. He did vast amounts of religious studies, history, chronology. He was interested in many, many things, and he had this great power of concentration. He was able to sort of hold something in his mind for days and weeks and worrying away at it until he got what he felt was a satisfactory answer. And he was a real burrower, but it's difficult to get to know him. In other words, you know, if you went for a drink with him, it'd be very interesting to go for a drink with him. And he did, at least in his youth, he used to go to the tavern. There are surviving bills from his tavern to show that he certainly did put a few drinks away and did a bit of gambling as well, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been interesting to see. Yeah, it'd be very interesting to see what he was actually like to talk to. But as he got older, he got crabbier, I think, and more. He retired into himself. He got very selfish. He always was very selfish. So he was a very, very difficult, but very, very brilliant person.
Hmm. Is your play available anywhere on YouTube?
Not at the moment. It may be available by the end of the year. I'm doing it up in the north of England in December, and they said they will they're going to video it then and put it on YouTube.
Wow. I think I have to turn that off. Okay. Well, let's get into the subject of this morning. I want to do a couple things on your own background and your own research, because to me, the interstellar medium has always been a hider of mysteries, going all the way back to what Trumpler and the guys at first realized that space was not empty.
Right.
What got you focusing on that aspect of a very interesting astrophysics career?
Well, as you mentioned in your very kind introduction, a lot of the research I did over the years was on the origin of the chemical elements and where they came from. And as you and many of your listeners will know, all the chemical elements are formed basically in stellar explosions or inside stars.
Did you work with Fred Hoyle at all?
I did work with him a very little bit. When I first came to Cardiff many years ago, he was an honorary professor in Cardiff for a few years, and I did know him a little bit then and did a little bit of work with him, but nothing terribly serious. He was getting quite old at that time, and I have to say I didn't entirely agree with all of his ideas at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very interesting career. Again, an interesting and perhaps somewhat difficult man who did some very, very brilliant work early on. Most of his career he had some marvelous ideas, some not so marvelous, but the marvelous ones certainly outweighed the effect of the less marvelous ones. But as he got older, the ideas he had tended to get a little bit more cranky. But he was a very, very interesting guy. And in fact, there is a link with the origin of interstellar material, because as I was saying, I'd been interested in how the elements, chemical elements, were formed. That's what I was doing a lot of research in. And I began to think about the processes that then move these chemical elements around the interstellar medium. In other words, you produce them in stars, there are stellar explosions, and there's outflows of gas from stars that deliver, as it were, you know, deliver the pizza to the homes. It's the explosions of the winds out of the stars that put these new chemical elements out into the interstellar medium. Well, what happens to them next? Where do they go? How are they circulated around the interstellar medium? They must at some time, at least a proportion of them, go into new stars.
Mm-hmm.
And as new stars form, of course, as we know now, although we didn't know back when I first started research, a lot of them go into planetary systems too. I mean, as we know, we live on a planet which is basically a large lump of chemicals that have condensed in the interstellar medium.
Sure.
Most likely during the actual process of star formation. So I was getting interested in that process as to how do these elements move around the interstellar medium. And the question came up, well, how do they come out just as individual atoms, or do they come out from these supernova explosions and from massive stars? Do they come out in the form of solid particles? I mean, do they condense?
Or do they evaporate off red giants and red supergiants and just kind of float away into the interstellar medium?
Indeed, but it looks more like, and this is something, in fact, Fred worked on and his colleague Chandra Wickrama Singh way back in the beginning of the 1960s. and proposed, in fact, that a lot of this stuff actually came out of stars in solid form. In other words, in the atmospheres of the stars or in the supernova, they actually condensed into solid particles. And then those solid particles, they'd be very small, about a micron in size, which is, you know, a fraction of a millimeter, and come out into the interstellar medium. So it's really through that route that I got interested in really what was the origin of interstellar material.
So we're talking interstellar grains of stuff as opposed to atoms or molecules.
Yes, and that was my particular interest. And it had become, the time I started working on it in more detail in the 1990s, end of the 1990s, it became more important because people were looking, beginning to be able to look at very distant galaxies. And with new instrumentation that looked particularly in the far infrared, and they were finding that even very early galaxies that formed in the universe appeared to have a lot of dust in them. Mm. And this wasn't expected. It was thought that dust took a long time to build up in the interstellar medium, and it was sort of a late phenomenon rather than an early phenomenon. But from these observations, it appeared that there were a lot of interstellar dust in very early galaxies, and there was something of a mystery as to how it could have formed.
And some galaxies have incredible amounts of dust.
Indeed, and of very bright infrared sources, and often you can't, with them, you can't see through the dust at normal wavelengths, at optical wavelengths. They're very, very dusty, interesting things. So where did this dust come from? And I really worked on the theory with various colleagues and students on the idea that, in fact, a lot of the dust was actually formed in supernova explosions rather than in giant stars, which you've already mentioned. The traditional view was that it was giant stars that dust formed in.
And well, just because what? There's far more of them?
There are far more of them. They have atmospheres that might have the right sort of conditions in which dust might condense.
And then we have all those planetary nebulae, which, of course, are the next evolutionary stage.
Indeed, and you can see in some of those, you can see evidence of dust having formed and so on. But the problem is, and it's maybe a little bit subtle, but you know, you have to sit down and write down the equations and stare at them for a while. It's difficult to get the chemical elements that you formed in supernovae, which are the main source, the stellar explosions are the main source of the actual chemical elements themselves. If you're going to form substantial dust in giant stars, you really have to get the elements from the supernovae into the giant stars but as they form. In other words, it's a sort of two-stage process. You've got stars that produce the chemical elements, then the chemical elements go into the interstellar medium, then into the new stars that are going to be the giant stars, and then you form the dust from the chemical elements that have gone into the stars when they form.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that takes a while, and that's the problem, that process isn't a fast one and wasn't quick enough to provide the dust in these very early galaxies. So one went back to an idea which had been proposed by other people several times, is that during an actual supernova explosion, which is very, very violent and very, very hot and dense and all these sort of things.
Just for the sake of the folks listening who obviously have not tracked astronomy like you and I, what are the conditions in a supernova? Temperatures, sizes, duration, velocities? I mean, we're talking about some major, major bang, right?
Absolutely. And you're talking of a process that, well, it takes place really over a few hours to some extent, the actual sort of main supernova explosion, although the effects are visible for weeks. A massive star getting towards the end of its life, it's getting very, very dense. I mean, you know, as dense as anything you could imagine, getting very, very hot, billions of degrees in its central core.
It's impossible to imagine that kind of a temperature.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you don't want to be there.
Okay.
Under those conditions, there can be a runaway, and the nuclear reactions start up. It gets very even hotter and denser, and then the thing blows itself apart. And that sort of process takes a few hours, from minutes to hours, to actually begin to blow itself apart. And then that then expands out, and that will then become very, very bright in the skies. You know, some of these supernovae can be brighter than a whole galaxy for a few weeks.
And they expand at velocities of what, thousands of miles per second?
Yes, certainly. And 10,000 kilometers a second would be typical. So yes, they're very, very violent. But they're delivering this stuff then out into the interstellar medium. But it does appear as though, nevertheless, sometime during that expansion, the conditions are right that a dust can form out of the newly formed chemical elements. So this has an advantage because these stars, as I say, are very massive stars that explode, and they have very short lifetimes. They may be, well, once they form, before they get to the supernova, they may only exist about a million years or so, and then they explode and then deliver these freshly formed elements in the form of solid particles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it not only makes the stuff, it delivers it to you in solid form. No. And that's what we were looking at, to see whether that was a viable process. And indeed, it does look as though that is a viable process, and that a great deal of the interstellar dust may well come from those supernova explosions.
From the earliest ones.
Well, and continuing throughout the universe.
Well, I'm thinking of those galaxies that are so young they shouldn't have any dust, and they have tons of dust. So where did that come from?
Well, that come from these supernova explosions, that's right.
Okay.
But it's a process that would still continue today, although nowadays you would also have contributions from giant stars, which are more, not nearly so violent, but also have the conditions in their atmospheres and the elements from previous supernova generations to provide some dust.
So how did you segue from that extraordinarily intriguing set of observations into looking at an ancient artifact found in an ocean here on this planet?
Well, it's one of these things, like so many things, it's chance. It's just the way life's rich pattern goes.
Well, people love stories, so tell us the story. We have time.
I'll tell you the story. Are you sitting comfortably?
And by the way, something is rattling around in your computer, which is really kind of distracting.
I will try and I'm holding the computer, so I'll sit very quietly. Hopefully that will.
That would be a useful thing to do, yes.
Let me know if it keeps rattling. Okay.
No.
When I was teaching years ago, I had a great interest in the history and philosophy of science. It was just a sort of side interest. And what would happen is if anybody, any student in the department wanted to do a final year project, as all our students tended to do a final year project of some kind in astronomy or physics or mathematics. And if a student wanted to have a project in the history of science, and a few did, it would be me who'd get fingered in order to supervise them. And so I, over the years, did projects, assisted students in projects in various things. And one year, around 1999, I had a very interesting student who was a mature student. In fact, he was slightly older than I was, I think, at the time, who had come back after a lifetime making furniture and had decided at the age, I think, of about 50 or so, to do a degree in astrophysics, as you do, rather unusual.
Now, that is a route that I've never heard before.
Yeah. And he was a very nice guy, a very able guy, too. And he wanted to do a project in the history of science. Now, he's quite a practical chap, having used his hands over his lifetime to make furniture. And he said he'd want something practical, and he'd want something in the history of science. Had I got a project that he could do? Well, I happened to be reading a book on the history of engineering. And in this book on the history of engineering, there was a picture of the Antikythera mechanism. Mm. Now, this is this lump of... Well, it's been reconstructed from a lump of bronze that was pulled out of the sea around 1901.
Covered with calcium carbonate.
It was in pretty poor condition by the time it came out. It had been under the sea for about 2,000 years. But there was a picture of the work that a guy called Derek de Solla Price had done in the 1970s.
Well, wait, and didn't he publish something in Scientific American in the 1950s on the mechanism?
He did. What I had was a picture from his later work, which is a sort of, it was published as a paper, but then as a book called Gears from the Greeks.
But he did nice publish, title.
He did publish a very influential Scientific American article. I think you said 1957, I think
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, 1957. I remember reading it when it came out.
Ah, right. And that's an interesting article, in fact. In fact,
very.
He published some things in that he never published subsequently, so it was a very it's an interesting article to read. Anyway, he'd shown that this was consistent with this having some astronomical purpose, and there were some diagrams and so on, but it wasn't understood. That there are a lot of details about this thing that weren't understood. So I thought, well, that's an interesting thing. I don't know much about that. Sounds intriguing. Sounds mechanical. Perhaps the student would like to do a year's work on that. Finding out what people knew about it. So the student Phil, he worked for the year with me on trying to find out everything that was known about this strange device. And in fact, it went pretty well. He did some beautiful computer-generated diagrams of what people thought the gearing was. We traced up every reference we could find, and at the end of the year, we in fact actually published a review article called about. I try to remember the title of it now. It was basically, the anti-Kithra mechanism is still a mystery, because by the time we got to the end of the year, we realized that really we didn't really know what this thing did or exactly how it worked. There was still, and this was after maybe nearly 100 years of research, it still wasn't clear.
But this kind of research was looking at it using microscopes maybe or magnifying glasses, but nobody had used x-rays, and nobody certainly had taken the lump of limestone apart to look at all the stuff that was still embedded. So it was kind of like looking at this box, but you couldn't really see inside the box in any way.
Well, a bit had been done. The actual thing had been pulled out of the sea, as you mentioned, about 1901, and it was taken back, this lump. It was just a lump of bronze. It wasn't realized at the time. We'll talk about the shipwreck a little later on, I guess, but okay. It had come from the shipwreck, the discovery of this shipwreck at the bottom of the sea. It was this lump of bronze, which wasn't realized what it was at the time, was taken back to the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, a very, very fine museum. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's well worth a visit if you're ever in Athens to go and see this wonderful archaeological museum. And this lump of bronze had cracked open. And in fact, I'm told that it was a visiting minister of the government was wandering through. He was on some official visit or other. And he looked at this lump and he said, "What's that in there?" And he said, "It looks like a gear wheel."
Oh, my God.
And they said, "What?" hang on a minute.
Wait a minute. Up until then, you had this lump of limestone, and there was some things kind of visible sticking out, but no one knew there were actual gear teeth?
No, they didn't know that until it cracked open, and they could see that.
Now, how did it crack open? Did somebody drop it?
Well, it's an interesting question. Did it jump or was it pushed? Yes.
But it
may just be that it as it come out the sea, very often you get shrinkage and drying out. And
That's right. If you brought it up and didn't keep it in water, it would dry out and then it would crack because that's what that stuff does.
Yeah. Anyway, whether anybody hit it to see what happened. But anyway, they saw the gears, and that was a surprise, because metal gear wheels, and they knew this was a lump of bronze, metal gear wheels were not known from the classical era, and it was known that this was a shipwreck from Greek or Roman times.
Had they radiocarboned the planks from the ship at all?
Not at that time. Remember, this is back in 1901. So this
minister was really early on the scene when they brought it up, and it's sitting there and drying, and he's walking through, and it's like, oh, look at that.
Yeah, it was within a few months of
its discovery. Okay. I thought it might have been years later.
No. After that, some work was done in cutting it up a little bit and pulling it apart a little bit. It's that presumably originally when they brought it up, it was one fragment. It's in 82-ish fragments now, so there's been quite a lot of decomposition and break it apart over the years. So the evidence they had up until the time we started work was certainly visual inspection of all the surfaces and what remained. But what De Sola Price had done, along with a Greek scientist in the 1960s and 70s, had begun to do some radiography, in other words, some x-rays and other kind of investigation of that time. And there were reasonable x-rays of the bits of the mechanism surviving. And it was really those x-rays at that time, which is quite a long time, obviously, after the thing was discovered, that the true complexity of the mechanism became known. When you look at the actual exterior, you see a few gear wheels. When they had done the x-rays and counted, they found they were over 30 gear wheels.
Oh, my gosh.
They found 30 and therefore knew that the original mechanism had over 30 gear wheels. Now, that's pretty complex, and that was the real surprise. Nobody had the idea that the Greeks had anything like as complex a mechanism as that.
What was the estimate of
surprise?
What was the estimate of the age? And how were they have kind of tried to derive that?
Well, the age has always been known approximately because the ship was recognized that this wreck. Should I tell you the story of the shipwreck?
Yeah, by all means.
Story.
Oh, well, but hold that because we have to go to a break. My guest this morning is Dr. Michael Edmonds. We're discussing the Antikythera mechanism, and we're going to go back in time to a time when we didn't think that human beings were capable of high technology. Well, it turns out that we probably were wrong. We'll be right back. The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard Hoagland. My guest this morning is Dr. Michael Edmonds, and we're talking about the Antikythera mechanism, which, as far as I understand, is the most extraordinary example of what you would term high technology, 19th century, 18th century, whatever, but it was found to have originated thousands of years before the present. And Mike was about to tell us how it was found.
Well, what happened is quite a nice story. There was a group of sponge divers in the Mediterranean. They lived on the island of Symi, just a bit south of Greece. And once a year, they would go across to North Africa to do sponge diving and collect the sponges, then take them back and sell them. That's how they made their living. And to get these sponges, they would do underwater diving with primitive diving suits. So this was around in the year of 1900. Quite dangerous, quite a dangerous profession. Well, they were on their way across to...
And this is free diving. This isn't with anything that's technology. It's just basically what? Do you hold your breath a lot, or did they like little airbags, goatskin bags or something?
No, this was primitive diving suits. In other words, they'd have had an air compressor and sort of helmets and that sort of thing. So it would be like you've seen the pictures of the old very old diving suits with heavy boots. And
oh,
the,
okay, yeah. I kind of had the imagination that we're looking at young kids diving, free diving in the crystal clear waters.
That's right, and discovering pearls and princesses and sea monsters, yeah.
But this was a little more mechanical. Okay.
This was a little more mechanical, but as I say, pretty primitive and quite dangerous. Anyway, they were on their boat on the way across, and they were going across the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean is a very dangerous sea in many ways. People think of it as a sort of, a tranquil, beautiful blue ocean for holidays and so on. But it, for many years, of course, has been the great trading routes of the world have gone across the Mediterranean. But it can be quite a dangerous sea because storms can blow up very quickly, and they can be quite violent sort of storms. And the bottom of the Sea of the Mediterranean is littered with wrecks from classical era and before. Well, they were on their way across, and a storm blew up. So they sheltered in the lee of an island called Antikythera.
Oh,
that's
my.
Where we get this name from. Now, it's called Antikythera because it's near another island called Kythera, and it's just across the straits, and so it's called Anti, in front of or across from Kythera.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they sheltered in the island. In the end, the storm blew itself out. And they decided they would dive. Now, whether they were doing this because they were going to see if there are any sponges down there or to see whether they could get some clams for lunch or whatever, we don't know. Hmm. But they dived. And the story goes that very shortly, one of the divers came back up brandishing a bronze arm and saying there's a whole shipload of maidens down there. What's the fact? And when they'd calmed him down, they realized what they'd done. In fact, they obviously dived down again to see what was going on, but it was quite deep. This is the actual site of this is quite deep. It's quite difficult to dive. They discovered what they'd done is they'd discovered the wreck of a Roman era trading ship.
Okay.
And they didn't know quite what to do about this. They, in the end, told the authorities. After about 6 months, they told the authorities for various reasons. In fact, the authorities probably knew slightly before that. There's an interesting story connected with that. Anyway, what happened then subsequently was they realized that there's quite a lot of treasure on this ship. And what was really the first ever proper underwater archaeology took place.
On this wreck?
On this wreck, a expedition was got up between the Greek Navy, the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, and the relevant ministry.
This wouldn't be the first underwater excavation archaeology ever, right?
I don't know the history in great detail, but I believe this was the first sort of really major expedition of the kind.
Well, that's suitable to what they found.
And anyway, this took place in 1901, and this big expedition got up a lot of stuff from the floor and took it all back to the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, where it remains to this day. And as I say, if you're there in Athens, do go and see it. It's a wonderful collection of stuff. Because what they found there was wonderful classical era bronzes. We're talking about stuff that could be dated pretty well from its style and so on, from about 400 BC up to about 100 BC, that sort of time scale.
Mm-hmm.
And there were bronze statues, stone statues, even some very elegant glassware. There's some beautiful little bowls of glass.
Mm.
Looking for anything as though they could have been made in the 1920s. I mean, you know, beautiful things. But at the same time, a lump of bronze was found. It wasn't realized what it was. My suspicion is they probably thought it was the head of a helmet or something, you know, of a statue or something.
But it's about that size, right?
Yeah, it's about the right size. And that's what came back to the museum in Athens. That's what cracked open subsequently within a few months. Uh-huh. And it was then that was recognized as this mechanism. It was some sort of bronze mechanism. And which really, although it's not perhaps the most beautiful artifact to come out of this wreck, was undoubtedly the most surprising.
Gosh, yes.
Now, it could be dated because it was realized the ship was consistent with being a Roman era or Greek era ship, and all the things that were bought up were from this sort of era of about 4th century BC up to sort of, well, 100 BC, 50 BC, something of that sort of time. And the Antikythera mechanism came up with it. It was part of that ship, and therefore it came from that time.
Now, why would – I mean, maybe we're leaping ahead, and you have this in your narrative, but why would something that extraordinary – and remember, fossilization, you only get one out of, what, 10,000, 100,000? Fossilization is so rare to preserve what it preserves. So if this was initially rare to begin with, how did one of a kind or almost one of a kind wind up on a ship?
Well, there were various theories to begin with. I mean, one of the first ideas was this was something to do with the ship, that it's some sort of navigational instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But that is almost certainly not true. In fact, I'm convinced it's not true. If you look at, and we'll talk later, no doubt, about what this thing can do, it doesn't do any function that would actually help you navigate on a ship.
Okay.
That was the sort of idea, but it doesn't. So it's no use in navigation. What was undoubtedly happening, it was being transported. Now, whether it was part of a big hoard of stuff, as I say, there were these beautiful bronzes and statues and so on, were these part of some sort of booty or, you know, some sort of thing being transported up to Rome? Was it somebody moving their house? which, you know, that had to be done. I mean, the people moved around.
Yeah, of course.
The empires at that time. And
how big was the ship?
That's still not entirely clear. It was quite a I can't give you the dimensions in exact terms. Basically, it was a big ship.
Hmm.
Okay, may even in fact have been a very big ship for the times.
Hmm.
It, the wreck is still being investigated. We may talk about that later too. And there's diving going on at the moment to redive the ship, and we'll know a lot better about what the actual ship was like. But it was certainly quite a big ship. But people would, for example, suppose you are a Roman. Remember, this is before the shipwreck has been dated subsequently to about, well, between 85 and 60 BC, that sort of time.
Radiocarbon?
Partly radiocarbon. That helps in looking at the timbers of the ship, so you can find out when the ship was made. Mm-hmm. For many years, the dates from that were found to be rather odd. And in fact, much more recently, Oxford University have redated the radiocarbon date using a new recalibration. And they get a date of between about 200 BC to about 50 BC, so which covers this nicely. So that's consistent with the date we're talking about. It doesn't get it absolutely precisely. But also from the ship, there are coins on the ship, which can be quite accurately dated, particularly from Pergamon in the eastern Mediterranean.
Okay.
And those date from around 85-60 BC. Because, you know, and obviously they had to have been manufactured before they could be on the ship. So sure. That gives you some sort of last date for the ship. So it's fairly consistent that was the date. And there are other indicators too. There is, for example, the actual Antikythera mechanism itself has writing on it. It's got a lot of script engraved into it on the surfaces. And the style of the engraving or calligraphy, whatever you want to call it, the style of that can be dated fairly accurately. There's dispute about how accurately, as you can imagine, but maybe to within about 30 years, plus or minus 30 years, because there are a lot of bronze inscriptions existing from the Greek era, and the sort of way the letters were put together and the words were put together does vary over time. And experts, I'm no expert in this, but they say they can work out what the date is. And the date is something like the last bit of the 2nd century BC, around just before 100 BC or around there, plus or minus 30 years.
So this is the engraving on the bronze on the mechanism itself. So if the dating can be zeroed in a window of calligraphy, yeah, you can be kind of sure that that's the date of the mechanism that has the writing on it.
Yeah. So I'd say that the pretty well, the wreck happened sometime between 85 and 60 BC, roughly, okay?
Okay.
The mechanism was made within a few years of that, maybe 100 BC, but some people put it back about 200 BC, but we're there or thereabouts. It would be nice to have a really accurate date, but for archaeology, having a date within 100 years is pretty good.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And what there is no doubt at all about is that this was from this era. And as you say, you're astonished when you hear what it can do, and when we'll see what it can do is extraordinary. But there is no doubt at all that it is genuine, and it is from this era. That's firmly established now.
Which makes it the oldest piece of high technology we know.
Indeed.
Wow. So, moving on, what happened next?
Well, if you remember, we were talking about the fact that early on there'd seen some gear wheels. So this is almost very soon after it's been found, a few months after it's been found. So then the people think, oh, well, this is unusual. And they start looking at it and looking at it in more detail. And they begin to find some of these inscriptions on the mechanism. And there are words on it that indicate that it may have an astronomical purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Reading Greek words that imply a strong purpose. And then people then speculate, is it some sort of planetarium, some sort of orrery, as I said, maybe some sort of navigational instrument, but that's discounted now. And so things go on with some ideas and so on, but not very much being done until the work of Derek de Solla Price in the 1950s, 1960s and 1970s. He was an English physicist who came to America, worked in America. He was a well-known sociologist of science as well as being a historian of science.
Hmm.
And he really pushed the investigation a long way forward. It was his work doing radiography, as I say, doing some x-rays and so on, in the 1960s that made people realize just how complex the mechanism was, that it has 30 gear wheels remaining in it, and when it was built, it probably had more than 30 gear wheels in it. Huh. And he published a book. He published an article you've mentioned in Scientific American in 1957, and then a book about 1975 called Gears from the Greeks, in which he laid out the fact that this was some kind of astronomical calculator and had a fair stab at the various things that it could do. Now,
how did his theory meet the community at that time? Because that must have been, I mean, I remember kind of hanging around with Alexander Marshak in that time period, talking to him anyway, phones and whatever, and he was having an incredibly hard time selling the scientific community that our ancestors had anything that could create this kind of a technology at that early age.
Absolutely. You know, this is one of the sort of amusing side issues that De Solo Price did this brilliant work, published this book and corresponding articles. So these were known about. As you say, Scientific American was pretty well read those days, so people had read Scientific American. Mm-hmm. And somebody is quoted as saying, look, the Antikythera mechanism has sunk twice. It sunk once around 85 BC, 85 to 60 BC, and then again in 1975, after De Solo Price's book came out.
Meaning that his book just submerged beneath the waves and nobody heard a ripple.
Absolutely. I'm one of the... And some people did. There were some people who continued to work on it and do very interesting and useful stuff. And I particularly mentioned a guy called Michael Wright, who worked at the as a curator at the Science Museum in London, who did some very, very good work subsequent to Price's work and continued to work on it. He still does today. But there were, I think it was met with incredulity, as you say, classicists in particular, just didn't know what to do with this. It just didn't fit in to what went on. I mean, even
Wait. We've got Archimedes, we've got Hera, we've got a whole bunch of gadgets, I'll call them that loosely, from that time frame that shows that we were mechanical, we didn't know how to put stuff together. Was it the idea that we couldn't even begin this, or that it was just the complexity and the sophistication that would just blew their minds?
I think it was the complexity and the sophistication. Also, I think for a while it wasn't really clear what its precise functions were, and that makes it difficult, because if you don't know what it's doing, it's mysterious, it doesn't fit in. And that, I think, was probably what they had the problem with. I mean, even some well-known... historians of science had difficulty with this.
Are you familiar with the term ouparts?
Ouparts.
Yeah, ouparts. Out of place artifacts.
No, that's an interesting.
There's an actual term for this, and you're really kind of talking social dysfunction, where people see something and it's so out of context, they can't wrap their minds around it, and that sounds like how the reaction met this device.
Yeah, and even that there's a great, very great historian of science in the United States called Neugebauer,
who Gerald Neugebauer.
And he wrote a three-volume history of ancient mathematics and Greek mathematics, ancient mathematics,
right.
A huge volume. In that, the Antikythera mechanism is mentioned once in a small footnote. Now, it may be that he and De Solo Price had a bit of rivalry going on, but even so, that's pretty faint praise.
It really is. Now, was it just because of a prejudice? Did he think it was fake or out of place in the sense that it had fallen off a modern ship or something? Relatively modern?
There was always the worry. De Solo Price himself admits that he used to wake up in a sweat at night sometimes, you know, wondering, you know, had it been dropped on the boat from a later age or something? And there are some people who still maintain that it's from a later era. But it isn't. Everything about it is exactly right for its era. To imagine it was a fake is unbelievable, because to have faked this within a few months of it being the wreck being discovered and, you know, putting this in the museum and faking it, so just impossible, mm-hmm. just impossible. But everything about it, the way it's made, the inscriptions, More particularly from my point of view, too, I'll talk in a minute about what it can actually do. And the things it can do are absolutely right for what they knew about astronomy at the time.
Oh, interesting.
It's just right. And in fact, one of my colleagues has gone as far as to say, well, maybe what this thing is a statement of what they knew about astronomy. Maybe that's what its purpose was. It was like a hardware publication, if you put it that way, saying this is what the universe is like. This is what we know about it.
But again, given that fossilization is so rare, the idea that you've got a one-of-a-kind out of thousands of years just seems almost statistically impossible.
Well, yes, no. This certainly wasn't the only one ever made.
And we know that how?
Well, one thing I've done since we began our work, we obviously did a lot of investigation of this particular device. But what I've tried to do in recent times, which was following on from stuff De Solar Price and others had done before, is to try and find out from the ancient literature what was known about such devices.
Mm.
And this may be what the classicists hadn't really, well, I wouldn't say they hadn't done, but they hadn't really maybe taken enough account of. If you look carefully in ancient literature, you do find references to these devices. Now, I believe that they come under a term called spherae, spheres.
Okay.
And there were various kinds of spherae in the ancient world. They're referred to, as I say, in ancient literature. Some, I don't know if you've seen sort of a three-dimensional sphere with sort of bands on, sometimes called an armillary sphere.
Yes.
You've seen pictures of those.
Well, there's a huge, giant set of them in India.
Indeed. And these were known about in the ancient world. They're really a sort of observational sort of demonstration device. They show the tropics.
Pre-telescopic. You just basically have an alignment mechanism so you get sights and you track things through sighting through huge, massive gears and architecture that doesn't move, and then you get angles.
Yeah, you can use them like that, or you can use them as display devices to say, look, this is what the equator is, this is what poles are, here's
Oh, we're talking the desk variety, not the ones at Jaipur.
Okay, so that's one kind of sphere.
Okay.
But there were others too. There may have been three-dimensional type spheres, but possibly Archimedes may have been involved with, that did show, well, actually did have gears in and did demonstrate planetary motion and so on.
But we don't have any examples.
We don't have any existing example of that. What we do have is, in the Antikythera mechanism, is an example of a two-dimensional one.
Okay.
In other words, it has the same sort of function to show things in the sky and demonstrate motions and so on.
But it shows up on dials.
But it shows up on dials rather than in a three-dimensional. And I believe that those things are still called spherae. It's just a general term for this sort of...
Like we call tissues Kleenex, even though there's only one brand of Kleenex.
Absolutely. And if you look in the literature, I've had a bit of a burrow. I'm not a Greek scholar, but I've had a bit of a burrow mainly in translation to see how many references there are. Many of these were known before I started, but now I have at least 20 good references to the existence of devices like the Antikythera mechanism over a period of about 650 years in the classical world. And I can also...
So this could have been a mature technology.
Yes. And my guess is, if you want to... this is a pure guess. This isn't based on anything really other than a guess. It could have started 400 BC. It could have started about 200 BC. Somewhere around there, these devices, simple ones, not a complicated one like the Antikythera mechanism. And then they continue to be made, certainly up to, and I've got a very good reference for one, around 500 AD. And then there are a few bits and pieces that exist as actual artifacts beyond that time. There are some Byzantine stuff, which is coming from the Byzantine world, that are much simpler things. And then they lead into some geared astrolabes from the Byzantine world around, well, say 1000 AD or 900 to 1000 AD.
See, the thing, the mystery that I'm caught up on is if this was a relatively widespread technological database, if this kind of device could be produced because there was a heritage, there were the tools, there was the technology, there was the mining, the crafting of gears, the mathematics of ratios, if all that existed, why do you have to go through with a fine-tooth comb when you only find a half dozen or a dozen examples of maybe references to something that had to have a huge root, otherwise you couldn't produce a finished device like that?
Because there were not that many of them. I mean, there were certainly more than one, and I don't know how many would exist. Oh, gosh, how many would exist at any one time?
Isn't that an interesting question, though?
But there may have been only two or three factories, and a factory would have been one man and a dog, possibly.
A craftsman.
A workshop. So at any given time, there may not have been very many of these in total at any given time, but they did exist, and they were known about, certainly by the intellectual elite. Okay. Throughout that time. And if I can give you an example, you've heard, I don't know if you've heard of a guy called Galen, who was the sort of, who was a doctor, really. He's one of the sort of fathers of medical science.
Okay.
And around, I think it was just, I'm trying to remember his date. I think it's around 100 AD or something. Forgive me if I've got the date wrong on that one, but that sort of time. And there's a nice little bit he writes about that he's saying, well, look, he's describing some function in the body. And he said, well, look, this doesn't work like one of those astronomical machines.
Hmm.
You know, he obviously is aware
of something.
Of something like the Antikythera mechanism. And he's just using it as an example.
And when did he write this?
I think around 100 AD or so. I could
look it up. Oh, well, that's a really interesting reference.
Yeah, and there are other ones. As I say, that I've got about 20 that go right through from about 200 BC up to 500 AD, showing that these machines were known about throughout that time.
Hmm.
So there's a tradition, what you call a tradition. It doesn't mean they're huge numbers, but there are, you know, many examples or a fair number of these machines. However, why haven't they survived is what you're asking, really.
Mm.
They were made of bronze, on the whole, as far as we know. There may have been some wooden ones. Well, wooden ones would have decayed unless the conditions were extraordinary for preservation. You know, if they fell into some sort of bog or something, that's rare. Okay, so there may have been wooden devices. But we believe the predominant ones of them were bronze. Now, bronze is valuable. It's expensive to produce. It's not as valuable as gold, but it's still expensive.
I tell you what, why don't you hold that there? We're going to take a short break. And when I come back, I'm going to talk briefly, or I'm going to ask you a question briefly, about an 11,000-year-old wooden artifact. So maybe there will be wooden ones found. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Dr. Michael Edmonds. We are discussing the mysterious and extraordinary and ultimately fascinating Antikythera mechanism, and we shall be right back. We are back with Dr. Michael Edmonds this morning. So you were telling us about the possible rarity or non-rarity of these devices and the fact that maybe they just kind of almost all disappeared because of corrosion.
Well, many would have been lost through corrosion, yes, but I think probably what happened to more of them is that they were recycled. You see, it was made out of bronze, and bronze was valuable. It's, you know, it takes a lot of work to make bronze.
So when the Inquisition rolls through, it's grab this, grab that, like the guys in Egypt wanted to dismantle the pyramids to build Cairo.
Indeed. But I mean, even this even started in the classical era. I mean, there's a huge, apparently, second-hand bronze business around the Mediterranean in classical times. And then, of course, you get to medieval times, and they sort of start going into gun barrels. So if you've got something like an Antikythera mechanism, it's going to break at some time. It's this, you know, it's geared technology. I mean, how long will it last? 50, 100 years before something goes wrong? Mm-hmm. Once it's gone wrong, it's not really much use to you. Unless you can fix it. So most of them are probably just recycled. And the classic example of this, I believe if you look at classical bronze statues, you know, these beautiful Greek bronze statues, the majority of those have been found on shipwrecks.
Mm.
Now, that's not because people purposely carried bronze statues on shipwrecks. It's, you know, that's where they survived. They didn't survive on land.
Hmm. It's interesting that something could survive in seawater and be totally decimated on the ground.
Yes, and the conditions, I think, have to be right. This presumably was partially buried or completely buried under some sand or something that helped preserve it, although it has had a lot of calcination going on. And nowadays, the bits are extremely fragile now, and a lot of the metal is no longer metal but salts.
Hmm.
So it's a very, very, very precious and very, very fragile artifact, and the Greeks are very careful about how it's handled and what happens to it, very wisely so.
Now, before we get into what it does or what it did, of course, it still does it if you had... There are actually several incredibly interesting models that have been built, so we'll get into all that in a second. The question I wanted to ask you is, and I completely spaced. I have no idea what I was going to ask you. So go ahead.
Okay, so what did this thing do? Well, as I've mentioned, De Solar Price, this American physicist, British physicist who worked in America, did a lot of work in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and had realized that it had an astronomical purpose and probably had something to do with displaying the sun and the moon and their orbits and the relationship between the sun, moon, and the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we started work, which was around 2005, what we decided we would do, we knew we'd put together a research team from Greece.
This is you and this grad student or this student in astrophysics who wanted something mechanical to get involved in a project?
Maybe I'm leaping ahead a little bit. The grad student worked with me for a year.
Whose name was Philip, right?
Phil Thomas, yeah.
Okay, so we're crediting him.
Yeah.
Okay.
We published a review article at that time about what was known about this device and realizing that a lot wasn't known about it.
Like
and
most.
And we were wondering what could be done. And it happened that I'd been talking at this time to a colleague. I had a person I knew as a friend, a guy called Dr. Tony Freeth, who was a filmmaker. He had got a background in mathematics, but he was a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker who lived in London. And I said, look, this would make a great idea for a TV documentary to do something about this extraordinary device, because it doesn't seem to be known about nearly as much.
And nobody had done a documentary on this thing ever since it Price published in 57.
I certainly have. I'd seen little things, maybe a clip of 5 minutes or so on some science programs, partly due to the work of a guy I mentioned before, Michael Wright, who worked at the Science Museum for many years, mm-hmm. who'd done some reconstructions. But there had been no major TV documentary, certainly, on it. So we sort of thought this would be a good idea, and we started going round to various companies to get them interested in doing a documentary. This is around 2000, 2001.
You mean funding?
Yeah, getting some funding to do it. But whenever we talk to them, I say, well, what's new about this? You know, well, it's quite old, actually. But, you know, what's the new thing that you've discovered? You know, why is it we should do a documentary now? We say, well, no, we actually haven't done anything particularly new. It's just that nobody seems to know about this. And they all wanted some new stuff. We thought it would be nice to know something more about this. And so what happened in the end, we put together a research proposal. I contacted various people I knew or knew about in Greece to see if we can put together a research team. And we put together, in the end, a research team involving researchers from Greece, particularly Professor Xenophon Moussas and Professor John Seridakis from Athens and Thessaloniki. We got interested some industrial firms, Hewlett-Packard. We managed a guy called Tom Maltzbender, who was an imaging scientist at Hewlett-Packard. Also, a very modern X-ray company called, at that time called X-Tech, now part of Nikon Metrology in the United Kingdom, and their chief executive, Roger Hadland, who got very interested because we knew, and this was the whole point, if we were going to find out anything more about this device, we had to have much better imaging data. All we had to work on before we did our investigations, and we did some work, but it had to be done through looking at what had been published, typically looking at rather poor photographs in books or in papers that were difficult to interpret and so on. And we really needed modern data. So we put together a research proposal. We applied for permission to the Greek government to work on the device, and that took a while. It took us 4 years to get permission to work on the device.
Why so long?
Because we had to demonstrate that what we were going to do wasn't going to harm the device at all and was going to yield results. And anybody who does archaeology will tell you to get permission to do things is often a difficult and long process. And it was, but we succeeded in the end. And also we managed to get some funding from the Leverhulme Foundation, which was essential in being able to move equipment around so on, in order to do the work. Eventually that all got put together, and we went out in 2005 and spent two periods in Athens examining the mechanism in two ways. One way was to use a way of imaging all the surfaces.
Incidentally, if you go to our website, Mike, othersideofmidnight.com, and you click on your pages tonight, that we have a bunch of photographs which Ross, our producer, put up. So if you'd like to kind of go through some of the images and explain what we're seeing.
Okay, let me get that up. While I'm talking, I'll get that up on my computer.
Yeah, just go to othersideofmidnight.com and then click on your name, and that will take you to your page. And on your page, there's links, there's images, close-ups, there's a wonderful Lucite reconstruction. And then there's this photograph of this interesting guy who plays Newton on TV.
Oh, dear. I think I might know who that might be. Other
Side of Midnight.
Sideofmidnight.com. Okay. Side of Midnight. I'm a slow typer, you see.
Yeah. I use the Columbus system.
Right.
You hunt for a key and then land on it. It's an old...
Well, while I'm getting that up, I'll carry on saying about what we did. We were looking. We examined the. I've got it coming up now. We examined first of all all the surfaces by an imaging technique which had been developed by this guy Tom Maltzbender at Hewlett Packard, and that was a way of showing faint detail on the surfaces. It worked very well and gave us really good imaging data of the surfaces.
But it's just visual imaging, high-res visual imaging.
Really high-resolution visual imaging, but also that was able to bring out faint details, which, you know, because if you're looking for script, particularly because we were interested in finding out how much inscription we could find, it was very good. And then the other technique, which was the really critical technology, was this technology produced by this firm X-Tech in the United Kingdom. They were a high-tech company that produced very sophisticated X-ray machines for industry, particularly, for example, for doing things like examining turbine blades in jet engines.
Oh, for cracks.
It's that sort of thing. And they lent us a machine.
Wow.
Which was really good of them. They got
how expensive is such a machine?
Well, we're talking at that time, which is over 10 years ago, obviously, we are talking about $600,000 or something.
Don't drop it.
And in fact, they actually put together the highest energy machine they had ever built, called a Blade Runner machine. And allowed us to use it, and they came down, their technicians, and helped run it.
Wow.
Now, this, what I'd wanted to do, of course, was just to, I'd wanted to go to Athens. I'd have even bought a new briefcase, you know, one of those smart, you know, sort of metal ones that protect things, to put the device in to bring it back to the UK to do it. I've done that.
Wait, but you mean you want... Said,
this thing is not moving from the Athens...
Wait. You wanted to bring the Antikythera mechanism from the museum in Athens back to England
to
x-ray
it. X-ray machine.
Oh, wait, I'm confused.
The x-ray machine weighs 8.5 tons.
So it's not very portable.
It's not very portable. So I wanted to bring it back, but they said quite rightly, no, we're not. These things do not move. This artifact does not move from the museum. So if you can't do it that way around, we had to do it the other way around. And what we did, in fact, was we borrowed the machine, put it on a lorry. It was driven down through Europe. Into Athens in the early hours of the morning and into the basement of the National Archaeological Museum in Greece.
It weighs about
8.5 tons, this thing, because of lead shielding.
Good heavens.
And so it got in there, and it worked perfectly. And over a period of 3 weeks, we did very detailed x-rays.
This is in 2005.
And the advantage of this machine is it wasn't just really an x-ray machine. It's what's called a tomographic machine.
So you get three-dimensional...
It's like a body scanner. You know, you see these body scanners.
Yeah, of course. But
you wouldn't put your own body in here because it's rather high energy. It wouldn't be until you left.
You needed the high-energy x-rays to go through the calcium carbonate, through the bronze, through more bronze and out the other side... and actually give you images that were 3D.
Exactly. And that's what we did, and it worked. And then intense activity during the year or so after that, where we analyzed the results. And in fact, the major results were published in 2006 and 2008. Mm. And we're still working on some of it. Some of the inscriptions are still being worked on, because one of the things that worked very well from this x-ray stuff was not only did it allow us to work out the gear trains exactly, which was very important, the existing gear trains, but also gave us a lot more of the writing on this apparatus.
How in the world can you get writing on an x-ray? Because I would imagine the writing was just, you know, scratches on the bronze, and the amount of material is so little that there shouldn't be any difference in transparency. So solve my question for me, please.
Well, it's a three-dimensional machine, remember. You're looking at three-dimensional things. So if there's a lack of metal where the incision has been made,
right,
or that has changed to a different chemical, you can, in fact, see the writing.
Fascinating.
And when we started, I think roughly there are about 700 Greek characters known. I think we're up over around 3,000 now or so.
On this one machine?
Yeah. Yeah, so we have an awful lot of the inscription now, and that's very interesting. But first of all, what we were able to
do... So these guys were not into the 142 characters of Twitter?
No. they were much more verbose.
They were incredibly... Now, what did they say? What did the inscriptions tell us?
Well, the inscriptions are interesting, and it's not really... We wondered whether it was really an instruction booklet. It isn't really an instruction booklet. It's much more like a specification. I don't know if you bought any sort of electronic equipment or a new electric razor or something. You know, when you open up the package, a sort of large leaflet falls out.
Yeah, I'm filled with... This room is filled with electronic equipment, which all came with very complex instruction manuals written by someone in southern Japan.
Yeah, but as well as
who isn't quite conversant with English.
Yeah, but as well as the instruction booklet, you normally get a sort of specification which tells you what the thing does, probably in 15 different languages, as you say, and most of which you can't understand anyway. But says, you know, it's a 15 terahertz with 15 wobble stopper incubator thingamies.
Sure.
And really, this inscriptions are really saying what this machine did. And they're very incomplete, these inscriptions, but they do have things like saying, you know, there are certain periods here, there are certain relationships, there's things about eclipses, and there are things about planets and so on. So we're still working on those to some extent, but what they certainly show is that the thing was astronomical. And putting together with the gearing, and the gearing, of course, is absolutely fundamental because gears have teeth, and each gear has a fixed number of teeth. And if you can work out what teeth on what gear meshes with what teeth on another gear, mm-hmm. you can get the ratios of how the thing works and what the mathematics is behind it. And you can then connect that with what we know and what the Greeks knew about the ratios of periods of astronomical phenomena in the sky. Now, one of the very early things...
Let me understand. So you're looking at these ratios and what you can do, given our database of ancient astronomical knowledge from the period, you then relate those ratios to the ratios of real objects in the real sky moving around.
Absolutely. Let me give you an example. Already known from de Solar Price's visual inspection on one part of the mechanism, it's known that there are the numbers 19.
That sounds familiar.
19, 76, and 232, I think it is.
232. What in the world could that be?
233. Anyway, 233 maybe.
Okay.
That's right. I'll have to look it up. Anyway. Now, these are numbers. Now, 19 is the number of years in what's called a metonic cycle.
Right.
Now, the name
of our moon, moon.
Well, yeah. Now, metonic comes from the word meton. And Meton was a Greek astronomer. And he's credited, he was around 400 BC. He's credited with taking over from the Babylonian world details about astronomical periods into the Greek world. And this particular cycle, called the Metonic cycle, is a cycle of basically relating between the sun, and the moon, and the earth. Now, you'll have noticed that in a year, we have months in a year, January, February, March, so on, 12 months. But you'll also know that there are things called lunar months, which is full moon to full moon or new moon to new moon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many lunar months are there in a year?
13.
Well, approximately. Not exactly. Yeah?
Okay.
Because new moon doesn't occur on the same date each month.
Of course not.
Okay. And that's a bit of a nuisance, really. I mean, it'd be much better. You know, can you imagine you have... June the 15th is always a full moon. So then you can have your barbecue on June the 15th. Mm. You can always, schedule it in. It'd be great. Now, in fact, new moons and full moons had quite probably more significance than they had due to us in the ancient world. Often civic or religious festivals had to be celebrated at new or full moon. So there was a great interest in knowing when the new moons are going to fall. But with the normal year that we have, there isn't an integer number, that's a whole number, of lunar months in a year. So it's difficult to say exactly when the new moons are going to occur. So that's a major problem. Now, what the Babylonians, this is before the Greeks, had realized from watching the sky for many, many years, was that there were certain fixed period relationships, in other words, regularities. And one of the regularities was this 19-year period. And it works in the following way. If, say, tonight, I don't think we're just past full moon, aren't we? I think, if I remember.
Yeah, we have a beautiful gibbous moon in our land of enchantment desert tonight, almost bright enough to read by.
Can you guess what phase it is? Is it sort of two-thirds?
It's gibbous. It's between full and quarter, so I'd say two nights. It's about, 13 degrees per day times two. It's 26 degrees past full.
Okay. Now, the date today is
The 1st of September.
The 1st of September. Now, if you come back in 19 years, if we have another interview in 19 years, on this 1st of September...
You got a date.
Right? And you look out your window, your moon will be exactly the same phase.
Oh, how interesting.
Right?
Yep.
Now, if you know that, and you know...
That through long observation.
You know, therefore, that in fact what it is 235 lunar months make a period of 19 years exactly, or give or take a day.
Mm-hmm.
So once you know that, you can then work out when all the new moons are going to occur.
Hmm.
So it's a very useful period for knowing when new moons are going to occur. And in fact, that's one of the things that's displayed on the Antikythera mechanism. On the back of the mechanism, there are two dials. It's a very complicated dial. It's in a beautiful spiral form. It's got a five-turn spiral at the top and a four-turn spiral at the bottom. And the top dial there, that five-turn spiral.
Do we have images we can show folks? Because this is radio with pictures. They've all got devices and tablets and Androids and all that.
I can't see one on your website, unfortunately. If you go to the Antikythera mechanism website, which is in fact it says website the Antikythera mechanism research project at the bottom of your website,
right under your bio.
That's right.
So
it says there.
Click on that.
If you go to there, and I'm going there, you will in fact find some pictures there that will show this. But let me describe it anyway. I'll see if I can do the best I can. It's a spiral. So the top is a sort of five-turn spiral, and the bottom is a four-turn spiral. And the top spiral has 235 divisions on it. Now, as I mentioned, there are 235 lunar months in a Metonic cycle. And so that's
one of the two numbers everybody found on the device.
Exactly. And that.
Which has to say then moon. Something about this device was tracking the moon.
Tracking the moon. And that dial at the back has a pointer on that goes around.
Oh, how convenient.
Showing you for a given month what's happening in that month for the 235 moons of the cycle.
So instead of writing a table. Or a narrative or a graph, this is a mechanical device that actually is an analog computer with dials so that you can see where things will be when.
Exactly. And the bottom spiral, which is a four-turn spiral, is a similar sort of thing, but that is the other number, which I mentioned to you, the 230-odd, which is the Saros cycle of eclipses.
Oh. And
what that is, it's a similar sort of idea, again, coming from the Babylonians, from lots of watching. If an eclipse occurs, and you tell me, when does an eclipse occur? What phase of the moon?
Well, it's got to be full.
Yeah, or for it's got to be...
Oh, you're talking solar eclipse. Well, it has to be new or lunar eclipse is full.
New for a solar eclipse and full for a lunar eclipse, right? So you know what time of the month it's going to occur, if it's going to occur. Now, suppose in 1 month... an eclipse of the moon occurs, right? Then a Saros cycle later, is 230-odd months later.
Not quite a Metonic cycle.
Yeah, an almost exactly similar eclipse will occur.
In terms of geometry and where it passes across the Earth and all that?
Well, it's difficult to do the geometry because solar eclipses go all over the place. And you can't say, if I see a solar eclipse here, I'm going to see one Saros cycle later, because it may occur elsewhere on the Earth that you may not see. The lunar ones are much easier to see because you normally see lunar ones from a lot of places.
Oh, that's because you've got the rotation to also factor in on the Earth.
Yeah. But this cycle works that if an eclipse occurs, then a Saros cycle later, a similar eclipse will occur only about 8 hours later. Exactly 8 hours later, basically. So this bottom dial has, in fact, a Saros cycle on it, with the months in which an eclipse might occur marked on it. Now, that would have been done by looking at previous eclipses that they knew about and then using this rule of the Saros cycle to predict when future eclipses might occur. Because these cycles persist for many, many years. So if you've got a good table of eclipses that have occurred in the past 100 years or something, you've got a fairly good way of predicting what's going to happen in the future. And that's what this bottom dial does. It tells you...
This sounds like a hardware device that does similar things to what some have proposed for Stonehenge, except there you've got a huge solid-state device that just sits there and you move little things around, I think, in one of the models. And this, it sits on your table, and you look at the dials.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's 2,000 years. I mean, the Stonehenge data comes very ancient, much older than this, kind of. So
it is much older. At Stonehenge, you're looking about 2,000, at least 2,500 BC.
Yeah, but what's 500 years among friends?
Yeah, but to my mind, Stonehenge, I don't believe personally that it did the very sophisticated things that people claim for it. I think that's a lot of its wishful thinking. It was an astronomically aligned device. There's no doubt at all that its construction was associated with things like the winter and summer solstice. That's undoubtedly true. Mm-hmm. I don't personally think that it had the sophistication of doing all these more sophisticated things. You see, the information certainly that went into the Antikythera mechanism about eclipses and so on was from later periods. It comes from the Babylonians, and we're talking in the period from 1000 BC onwards. We're not talking way back in Stonehenge times. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that they weren't quite sophisticated and had some inkling of what was going on. I just don't think they were as sophisticated at that time. But by the time of the Greeks, they had got that sophisticated. Hmm. So here's a device, as you say, that acts almost like a hardware computer. It's not really a computer in the sense that you can't program it. It's already hardwired what it does, but it does do those very sophisticated functions.
I think they would call that firmware.
Firmware, indeed. So that's what the back of the device is doing.
It's showing you the motions of the moon and eclipses.
Yeah. And the front of the device is a little more problematic. We know that it certainly had a dial.
I'll tell you
to
what, before you get into the front, let us take another small break. We'll be back on the other side of midnight with my guest this morning, Dr. Mike Edmonds. We're discussing the Antikythera mechanism, which we now know is a computer in part to track the motions of the moon as we sail on and on the other side of midnight. We are back on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning is Dr. Michael Edmonds, and we're discussing this extraordinary, fascinating example of the only high technology that we've seen preserved for literally a couple of thousand years from an era of human history that, from what Mike has been telling us, I'm beginning to believe we know almost nothing about. Would you agree with that?
I'm not sure I'd go as far as that. I think we know an awful lot about it, really, at least not perhaps of the all the technological aspects we'd like to.
I was kind of thinking of the technology. I mean, how many other hidden technologies made out of fragile things that go away that were normal household or you know, other kinds of useful items do we have literally no gist of because they haven't survived?
Yeah, and that's always a problem. And interestingly enough, talking about survival, there are some things that are other sort of, in a sense, high-tech things that have survived from the Greek world. Some medical instruments, for example, have survived. Some of those quite sophisticated. Are you squeamish?
Depends.
Well, I've seen, for example, from Greece, a beautiful, beautiful capillary tube, you know, really, really tiny tube with a, you know, so that it actually has a hole down the middle, but which is fine enough to shove into an eyeball to drain off fluid.
Oh, I think I saw a doc on this.
Yeah.
And they're like precision 21st century surgical instruments, but they're extraordinarily old.
Yeah, exactly. Now, those have survived, of course.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but to me, the idea that you just have these devices pop out of nowhere, kind of like virtual particles out of the ether, is simply not in the cards. There has to be a knowledge base that is not only really significant and sophisticated, but capable of being passed down generation to generation to generation to generation.
Indeed. And undoubtedly, in the Greek world, there was. The And maybe in other civilizations too. I mean, certainly we know the Roman world had some, although the Roman world, for some reason, didn't seem to really develop very much this technology, this particular technology. It survived to some extent through the Roman world, but doesn't seem to have been much developed during the Roman world.
Hmm.
But it's the thing, as you say, about survival. Some things do survive, but only if they're particularly useful or particularly beautiful or particularly valuable. A lot of stuff just doesn't. I mean, a classic example, I don't know, might be, you know, do you remember the Sony Walkman?
Of course.
Have you still got one?
No.
What happened to yours?
I never had one.
Oh, a deprived childhood or whatever. But
I have a Sony Discman.
Indeed, but how long will that survive before you use, you know, you presumably you have an MP3 player now,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, of course. Yep.
So
yep.
Do you use your Discman much now?
Matter of fact, I'm playing music tonight on it over the show.
Well, there we are. Okay, so that's surviving because it's still useful. But, if you think of how many sort of Walkman-like tape players were produced, how many survive?
Well, and again, we're talking millions in our culture, and in this culture, we're talking what? How many of these devices do you think would have been in existence and preserved because they were valuable?
It's really difficult to make that estimate. What I would suggest is that
you can't back engineer from what they were used for. In other words, if you have a form follows function, if you got a thing you want to do, how many people are going to create something to do that function if it's really
useful?
Yeah,
how many people are going to be prepared to buy one?
Yeah.
If you want a real guess, and this is a real guess, it's not really based on anything much. At a given time, suppose we take a given date, I don't know, zero, say between BC and AD, around that time, zero, okay? Mm-hmm. Although it's not zero, you know what I mean.
But birth of Christ window.
Yeah. Perhaps my guess would be there might be between, I don't know, 50 to 100 of these machines at most.
Hmm.
At most, probably.
And you're basing that on?
Just on the fact that we have one, which survived, that we have literature stuff that tells us that these were around for at least 600, 700 years.
The spear references.
Yeah, and the fact that people talked about them and knew about them. So it could
So they had to have seen them, so they had to be not incredibly scarce. Yeah. They had to be enough of them so that it was kind of, yeah, they're out there.
Yeah, so but that could be between 10 and 100, something like that, and just very roughly. So that would be my guess, but it's purely a guess.
Okay. So, all right, you were going to describe the front.
Yeah, now the front of the device, if you look at it, it has some scales on a round scale, rather like a clock face, but with a round face.
And we don't have any images of this up on our site?
Now, if you look at your site, if I can find it back again, if you look at your site...
Other Side of Midnight, for everyone who's clicking frantically.
Yeah, on the other side of midnight. Where's it gone? I've lost it. It's here somewhere.
It's hidden down there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm getting it up now. If you look, you've got four images there. Can you see the above my little biography?
Yeah, sure.
The top. If you look at the top left there...
Yep.
There's a very nice reconstruction of what probably or possibly the front of the device looked like.
Oh my God! This thing could have been made out of China yesterday.
Yeah. And what that shows, we know that. Can you see around it? There are sort of a double circle, a double annulus, as we would say.
Yeah, with little gradations on it.
Yeah. Now, that is basically the zodiac around there, the region of the sky that the sun moves through during the year. So right. It shows the zodiac signs of, you know, Libra, Gemini, etc.
Yeah, called the ecliptic.
The ecliptic, right. And basically, there's an indicator that shows the position of the sun in the sky. That's where the sun is in the ecliptic.
Okay, is that the black one?
No, the black one I'm coming to, the one that's the sun. See if you can pick it out. Can you see there's a little golden globe?
Down around the 5 o'clock position?
5 o'clock, at around 5 o'clock. Now, in fact, in the inscriptions we were talking about earlier, there is a thing that says there is a pointer with a little golden globe.
Ah, really?
Yeah. That obviously shows the sun.
Ah.
And that shows where the sun is from month to month. As you know, around over a year, the sun moves around this area of the sky. And it's what gives you your birth sign. You know, the sun, your birth sign is where the sun was in the sky when you were born.
Now, we're looking here, obviously, at a modern recreation. Are there any of the original fragments of this that actually are the little gold ball?
The gold ball, no. Oh. What it does survive is a bit of those scales, the ones you say you mentioned that you can see the little gradations.
Yeah, the little gradations.
Yeah. So we've, you know, those can be analyzed quite accurately to show exactly, you know, what their dimensions were and what they did. So mm-hmm. part of this shows where the sun is. Now, you ask about little black.
Yeah, the little black one up at the, you know, like near midnight.
Now, that is a pointer.
Oh, is that the moon?
It shows where the moon is in the sky.
And it shows phases.
And it shows phases with a little half-silvered ball. And the half-silvered ball turns to show you what the phase of the moon is.
Ah. But that means there has to be more mechanical linkage to make the damn thing turn.
Absolutely. And in fact, the way this thing works, the whole thing works, there's a handle on the side of some kind of this device. And you turn the handle.
You turn the crank.
And when you do that, all the various gear trains in the device move as you turn the handle.
Okay. Have you been able to analyze the precision, the mechanical precision of the manufacturer of the original? Because that requires
really fine...
I have. Good.
I have. In fact, that was a bit of work I did a few years ago. I carefully looked at all the gears in the mechanism and worked out how accurately they had been made. Because these are probably hand-cut gears. In other words, that have been laid out and then cut, probably with a file, by hand.
How do you know? How do you know there wasn't a machine to make gears?
Because they're not completely regular.
Okay.
And it looks as though they were hand-cut. And what I was able to do was, it's a statistical analysis, whatever. You can work out roughly how well they can make gears. Now, having got that information as to, you know, the rough way, exactly how well they can make the gears, I then made lots of computer models of the device varying the precision with which the gears had been made, and working out how accurately it would have been able to predict the phenomenon.
So you created an electronic model in the computer with various imprecisions, and then just let it run and see how it drifted off.
Exactly. And that was very informative, because it showed, you know, how accurate the device was likely to be. And surprisingly enough, well, maybe not surprising, because otherwise it wouldn't have... Nobody would have bought it. It wasn't at all bad at doing those things. You remember I talked before about the dials on the back of the machine?
Yes.
Now, it certainly was able to give you the month, okay? In other words, if you were using the device and you wanted to know, you're going to predict an eclipse, odds on it would have indicated the right month for the eclipse. It would rarely have, perhaps once or twice in using it over a period, you might have got the wrong month, but almost certainly you'd have got the right month. So it was good at doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the front, it would certainly show where the sun was in the sky pretty accurately. The only thing it wasn't quite so good at, and the reason is, was the moon. And the reason for that is because the moon pointer moves much faster than the sun pointer, because if you think about it, The sun equivalent, the sun only goes around the Earth. Of course, the Earth goes around the sun. I'm not suggesting, but you know what I mean.
You have to think like a Greek.
That's right. The moon, essentially, the sun goes around the sky once a year.
Yes.
Whereas the moon goes around 13 times.
Yep.
Essentially. Now, because of that, the gearing gears up the moon motion, and the errors in the gear teeth
will amplify.
Get amplified by the same amount.
Hmm.
So if you were using this, the moon might be a bit off. If you try to predict when new moon was by noting when the sun and moon pointer coincided, because then they'd be in the same direction, which would be new moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could be 1 or 2 days off, typically in a month. But it would be within 1 or 2 days.
Now, these are the errors you figured from the mechanics of the device you've actually been able to analyze.
Yes.
So with that kind of error, wouldn't the maker say, oh, that's not good enough, I can do better?
No, I think not.
Okay.
It's probably on his limits. And for what this device was being used for, might well have been sufficiently accurate. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
But can I just, while we're looking at the front, let's look at the other thing that the front
did. And keep in mind we've got less than 15 minutes left.
Okay, well, let's cut to the chase then. On the front too, there were almost certainly other indicators, and you can see them on the picture that we're looking at, which showed the position of the known planets in the sky.
Is the red one Mars?
Yeah, that's right. We believe they had semi-precious stones that sort of indicated which planets were. And they would have been Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the planets they knew about. And the gearing, we believe, although this is a problem, this part of the mechanism is missing.
Oh.
It was presumably torn off in the shipwreck or before or whatever.
So it's not just corroded, it was mechanically separated.
It was missing. And what we've done is we know from the inscriptions imply that it did have a planetary display there. There's very good evidence from the inscription there was. And we have to speculate about how the actual gearing for the planets was done. It's not difficult to do. If they could do the other things, because one thing I haven't talked about is that the way they display the lunar motion, the moon, is very subtle. It has some of variations in that are very subtle and uses very sophisticated mechanics in order to be able to predict the subtlety of the motion. And knowing they could do that, we know that they could do this gearing for the planets. But it doesn't exist.
Hmm.
And the planetary positions wouldn't have been as good. Now, that's not because they were bad at making things or because of the errors in the gearwork, although there were some. The problem is, if you want to produce really accurate planetary motions, you have to have very long trains and very sophisticated gearing. And they hadn't bothered or they hadn't got that far. They'd got enough to do reasonably well, but not perfectly.
Or the device, in other words, the more complicated you make a device, the more expensive the device in any culture. So if it's only designed to do a certain thing, it doesn't need to do that thing plus more?
Correct. And the question, of course, presumably you're going to ask me now, is what was it for?
Yes, exactly. We've all come 2.5 hours, 2.75 hours, and you're going to tell us, drum roll please, what did they use it for?
We don't know.
Oh, come on, Mike. You can't do that.
I'm afraid I have to. I can give you some speculations as
well. Oh, please, please.
But interestingly enough, nowhere on the in the inscriptions we've found, and nowhere so far in planetary in the classical literature, have we found anything that really says what this was used for. It existed. People knew about them. So
okay, let me stop you there then. To me, the first thing that occurs to me is it did not have a label or a description because it's so well known. It's like, you know, you introduce someone, he's so well known you don't need to introduce him.
Absolutely.
So this actually was, oh, it's one of those.
Yeah. Now, what are the most likely things? Well, you could say, is it a calculator, you know, for doing astronomical calculations? Well, if you want to do accurate astronomical calculations, you're better off getting an astronomer to do them for you with papyrus and whatever it is, because they could do it more accurately at that time using more sophisticated methods on paper, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't think that really it's a device that an astronomer would have had to do his calculations. He could do it himself probably better.
So this is a vox populi. This is a democratized technology that was so familiar to some people, a class maybe, that they didn't even have to have a name on it. It was that thing that does that thing.
Yeah. Now, either it could be something that was to show these things, somebody could calculate these who didn't know how to do it, but could just do it by doing it by the machine to impress people. So was it in a temple or something like that? That's mm-hmm. a possible.
Mm-hmm.
More likely, I think, that it's a kind of, I wasn't going to say executive toy, because that sort of makes it sound rather negates it. I think it was a sophisticated device, sort of thing that demonstrates what's known about the universe, right?
You mean something like a very rich person who could afford this ship and carrying stuff from one place to another would have as part of his or her collection?
Possibly. And it would be sort of something, if you had enough money to buy this, it was an expensive thing, probably not very expensive. I'll come back to that if you like, to sort of give some idea of what it would have cost. But it's something that you might like to have on your mantelpiece to impress your friends.
Wow.
To show that you take an interest in the universe.
Oh, wow.
You know, maybe it's like having the latest, iPad or the latest, smartphone.
Or a Tesla.
And it could have been an educational device, of course. It would be very useful for teaching.
Look, this Hellenistic world really looked at the sky totally different than we do. And we're not going to have enough time to get into this really interesting. So we're going to have you back to talk about more of this. Because to me, the end use, why a culture would need to know the things about the sky that this could tell them in a portable fashion, that to me opens up another Pandora's box of end uses, of cultural knowledge, of relationship, of our relationship to the cosmos, and how the Greeks then viewed this as really kind of important information to have.
Yeah, indeed. And remember, probably as we were talking about Stonehenge earlier, we're talking about the Greeks now. Remember, the sky was much more present to them than it is to us. I may be out in the American desert, if you go out camping or something, yeah, you suddenly realize.
I just have to step outside my office.
Yeah,
stunning out there tonight.
Yeah, but most people in the middle of New York or San Francisco, do they see the sky?
Nope.
Do they
have? Nope. Yeah, you can probably see second, third magnitude maybe from Central Park, probably not now.
But you will see the moon.
Yeah.
At least you see the moon and you see the sun. But I think they were much more conscious every day of seeing the sky because of the lighting conditions and so on. And the calendar wasn't the fixed thing so much that we know, and a lot of the astronomical stuff was to do with fixing the calendar and when particular festivals took place and so on. So in a sense, maybe they were closer to the sky in terms of living with it than we are, although we, of course, nowadays are much more conscious of space because of what we see on the TV and what we learn about space.
When you come back the next time, I want to lay a theory on you as to why that fascination, that intimate connection was really kind of essential at this cultural level, why this actually might have been ejected from the culture as a significator because of the importance of what they were thinking in terms of our relationship to what's up there. But we have no time to go into that tonight, so I'll just tease you that we've got some very interesting data, including graphs, charts, mathematics, and all that, that might play into what this ultimately was trying to keep track of.
Okay, and I'll tease you with the thought that this development of a mechanical device that could look at the way the heavens worked, that was causal, deterministic, in terms of if you turned the gears, they always turned in the same way,
mm-hmm.
that had a single prime mover, you turned one knob and it drove everything.
In sequence.
And also showed both regular and irregular motion, to my mind, would have fired up and may have had a profound influence on their view of the universe and the development of astronomy and physical science.
Well, the idea of predictability, I mean, if you come from a legacy where nature is unpredictable and dangerous and kills you at every random moment, the idea that you could actually put predictability in a box and show it, that must have been a stunning intellectual, emotional, I finally got a handle on this. I'm the top of the heap. I'm the king of whatever because I can predict the future.
Indeed. And you put that against the sort of random events and, as you say, unpredictability that you find in Homer's books, in the Odyssey and the Iliad.
Mm.
Yeah, it must have been wonderfully attractive to be able to think there's some stability. We're beginning to get a hold on this. We're beginning to rationalize the world.
So again, textually, if that was going on in the culture, psychologically, among those who had these devices, how come it didn't permeate the rest of the culture that we are better than nature because we can get a handle on nature?
Because, I don't know, maybe because it still had a long way to go. Still a pretty difficult time to live in. you know, here the Greeks beginning to think about these things. You've got the nasty Romans coming, who are not necessarily going to be very kind to you. There's still plagues, there's still slavery, there's still dreadful illness, there's all sorts of nasty things going on. It's not necessarily the nicest of times to live.
No. But it's the beginning of a science where if you can conquer the heavens, the cosmos, the ineffable, the untouchable, what else could not be done by humans in the way of getting on top of problems?
Indeed. And what I think is, interesting enough, this is the beginning of real physical sciences and mechanics, something that people have sort of thought really happened around the 15th, 16th century AD with Galileo and Newton and so on. I think a lot of those
things. Did you ever see Sagan's Cosmos? You must have.
I've read the book.
You haven't got to see the films, and not the new ones that what's-his-name has done, but the original ones Carl did, because he has a section in there where he has starships leaving the Earth with Greek lettering, you know, their names in Greek. And he has this line, he says, if something had not happened to cause the progressive, you know, dark ages of the human race, based on the Antikythera mechanism and what he understood when he did that show in the 80s, he felt we now could be traveling to the stars if progress had continued uninterrupted from this technology.
That's possible. The interesting thing is that the Greeks didn't have an industrial revolution. And industrial revolutions, which are, you know, what gave rise to the bulk technology today, I guess, they have to have other conditions other than a few people being very clever. There are all sorts of economic and political arguments, political things that have to be right for an industrial revolution. And the Greeks didn't have it. And instead, we went, as you say, into the Dark Ages. Mm. Let's hope we're not going into another one.
Indeed. I have one final question. We've got less than 30 seconds left. There was a new expedition in 2014 to dive, or it's currently ongoing. Where does that stand? And that's what you'll have to come back and tell us about next time.
It is ongoing. It's to do with Woods Hole Oceanographic and Brendan Foley, the main lead guy there. They're going back to Antikythera, and they're diving the site. And it's going to tell us a hell of a lot more about the wreck and what was in it.
And are they looking for other examples of this mechanism?
Well, you never know. If one was being transported, the real hope is that perhaps there were more than one being transported. And
amazing.
It would be wonderful to have another one.
I want to thank my guest this morning, Dr. Michael Edmonds. We've been discussing the Antikythera mechanism against the background of our own technological development and the fact that it was foreshadowed 2,000 years before this conversation tonight is pretty amazing. Well, that's the end of The Other Side of Midnight for this morning. We'll see you again tomorrow morning. Until then, later.